Welcome to the Investing in Real Estate podcast with Clayton Morris. This is the show where we focus on buy and hold real estate. Why do we do it? We do it for the purposes of creating passive income and legacy wealth for you and your family. If you're interested in finding your freedom number, come over to our website at morrisinvest.com/freedom and download your free financial freedom cheat sheet today. Welcome in, everyone, to the Investing in Real Estate podcast. I'm Clayton Morris. She is Natalie Morris. And you have heard us over the past many months talking about our guest that we have on today's show. I'm excited because we're going to do a two-part episode with Andrew Howe. He's one of the co-founders and managing partners of the Salt Lake City law firm York, Howe, and Guyman. Mr. Howe represents clients in, with respect to real estate planning, probate, estate administration matters, charitable giving, and sophisticated business and tax planning matters. Natalie and I started working with Andrew maybe like last year or so, and Natalie read his book, Entrusted, Building a Legacy That Lasts, and she was like, wow, I can't believe a book on building trusts for your family legacy is actually compelling and a page-turner, and it was, and it's really set the path for what we do for building legacy wealth in our family. We talk about that here on the show all the time. How do you build legacy wealth? How can you make sure that the wealth you're building today is being handed down to your loved ones effectively, efficiently, correctly? And that's what we're going to talk about on the show today. Natalie is here with me holding a baby, and Andrew is here also. Andrew, great to have you on the show.
I'm so excited to be here. It's been such a joy to work with the two of you, and you've been fabulous promoters of me and sent some great clients my way, and it's just a real honor to be here with you this morning.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here. And, you know, Natalie and I, it's funny when we started down this journey, it's amazing how much we don't know when you're starting this. I mean, nothing we've ever been taught in school about estate planning, how to build that legacy wealth that you're able to hand down to your family. So many families, unfortunately, you know, end up going through probate. They end up losing things. They end up not being able to hand down to their family the wealth that they've tried to build.
Absolutely correct. In fact, you know, 70% of the population doesn't even think about this stuff. And it's not a very fun topic, to be quite honest, you guys, right? Death and taxes and speaking with a blood-sucking vampire lawyer. So everybody has a tendency to put it off. But, you know, what are two of the certainties in life but death and taxes? So, it's really difficult. It's one of the biggest hurdles in my job is trying to get motivated to talk through these things. So anytime I get a chance to have a stage where people are already excited to talk about these topics, it makes me feel special.
So on today's episode, we're going to talk about basic estate planning. Then in part two, our next episode, which will air next week, we're going to talk about business entity structuring. So Natalie, you want to kick off today's episode?
Yeah, I want to sort of start off by saying thank you for writing a book like this, because not only is it about death and taxes and how to prepare for those things in a very like formal kind of way, like this is what this means and this is what you should be thinking about, but it's a very holistic book about how to plan to pass down not only your wealth, which includes money, but your human capital, your experience, your values. And so I was really inspired after just the first chapter. I was like, oh yeah, this is something I want to be reading, because I want to figure out how to not just pass down. You talk about the spark versus the flame, the flame being the money and the spark being the way that you make the money. I want to pass down the spark to my children. So that's, I mean, it's such a great philosophy. Can you just sort of go over your overarching theme, what it means to do entrusted planning?
Absolutely. So my partner, David York, and I, who is my co-author with the book, we have both practiced in estate planning our entire careers, and we didn't meet until a little bit later into our professional lives, but we had come to the realization both that estate planning these days is being done fundamentally incorrect, or I should say incongruent with some of the more modern ways people are starting to think about estate planning. It seems like younger generational levels are viewing the passage of wealth in a much more dynamic way than it has in previous generations, with, you know, the greatest generation, people going through the Great Depression and not having assets. Assets were a very important thing. And most of the estate planning that is still done today is focusing on the passage of assets and not the passage of what we consider to be true wealth, which is a much broader definition. And we've kind of we kind of came to these three core assumptions that we feel are wrong, which was, you know, first and foremost, whenever we were doing work for a client, one of the very first things that you find out about a client is how much are they worth? And as that developed over our practices, we came to the realization, you know, first of all, that where most planners think that a person's net worth can be found on a balance sheet, it clearly can't be. I mean, your collection of life experiences, your failures, your successes, and what you might want to pass on to the next generation, not just the success in terms of financial wealth, but how you were successful is an extremely important thing. So again, fundamentally, a person's true wealth cannot be found solely on a balance sheet, but it needs to be a collection of a lot more than just that. The second kind of fallacy that we found going along within our practices is we do have a tendency to work on higher net worth clients. And there was this fundamental belief that if you can give your children or next generation some assets, then giving them even more is even better. There's sort of this never-ending return on benefit. But in fact, we all know that there is sort of this inverted U-curve where at some point in time, the benefit of what's being given can actually hinder that person. And it doesn't necessarily mean that if you transfer some is good, that more is going to be even better. And trying to figure out where that point is in time, where that diminishing rate of return is coming in the benefit of what you're leaving your beneficiaries is a very important thing to try to figure out as well. And then finally, we were found out, and this is really a slam to my own profession, that when people want to do their estate planning, the very first person they go to is an estate planning lawyer. And we feel that that's sort of putting the cart before the horse. We very much like a family and that we're working with to get very clear about who they are as a family unit. What are your core values and family missions and all of these different kind of things that, you know, make the Morris family unique. And using that as our North Star, first figuring out what that is, and then building the estate planning to match that as opposed to going backwards. And I mean, not having that goal is a really difficult thing to try to prepare the documentation when there isn't anything on the horizon to actually go for. So the purpose of the book was to really go through, and there are a number of books that are written on topics like this, but we could never find anything that met in the middle. And what I mean by that is most of the books are either really touchy-feely, right? They're the kind of the classic self-help book. You can do anything you want, and you can make your kids the next Rockefeller and Rothschilds. And certainly there's nothing wrong with that kind of an idea, but it didn't have much teeth into how you actually would go ahead and accomplish that. So the other side of that equation were these very intricate, you know, legal treatises and so forth that we use in order to find out, making sure we're using the right code sections and what all of the experts in these various areas of the law say, but no layperson wants to read any of these things. I mean, it would put you right to sleep, you know, faster than any Ambien you could take. So our goal was to try to do both, where give people a flavor of where we really do see estate planning going based upon these changed views through the generation, but also give some meat in how you can actually do that. And we've identified kind of these seven core principles that families that have successfully been able to navigate this have in common. And these are kind of these fundamental ideas that you want to at least think about if you're interested in having kind of a more holistic view of how your wealth is passing.
You give these examples in the book, and the story about the Vanderbilts versus the Rothschilds, really, it made me send your assistant a really scared email about like my estate planning, because these are two, you just opposed these two families as a family that did it right and then a family that did it way wrong. And maybe you can give us those examples, because that scared me enough into wanting to, you know, put in place these systems. And then I'll just share with you that I told your assistant, I was like, can we put it in the will that they can't, or in our trust, that they can't use their money for big lavish weddings? And she was like, well, that's pretty specific. So can you give us these two examples so that we understand why we're doing this?
Yeah. And I think it goes back to something that you had said earlier, Natalie, about one of the things that you had taken away from the book, that kind of the difference between the spark and kindling versus the roaring fire. And what I mean by that is that the Vanderbilt family really spent time passing on the fire, right? The burning logs, the money, and it would pass on through the generations without much direction to it. Now, what's funny about this is my partner, David, also did a TEDx talk on this topic about a year and a half ago. And he also spends some time talking about the Vanderbilt family. And we actually got an email from the Vanderbilt, a member of the Vanderbilt family about a month and a half ago, asking us to look at their estate planning. It was kind of interesting. So hopefully they don't read the book. But this, I'm assuming this was an arm of the Vanderbilt that didn't fall down this path. But what happened, right? Cornelius Vanderbilt, who was factually the most wealthy man to ever almost sit on the face of this earth. I mean, his combined net worth was like $143 billion. And you think about Bill Gates right now being $78 billion. He's twice as wealthy as Bill Gates alone. And what he did is part of his estate planning was to just pass on that wealth. He kind of did that old traditional estate planning model, which is, you know, if pass on some financial wealth is good, we're going to pass on even more. And by 1976, there was a reunion at Vanderbilt University. And there were at least 100 Vanderbilt descendants there, and not one of them there was a millionaire. But you take this other approach, which is this, well, I don't want to pass on that burning log. What we want to do more than anything is to try to get our next generations to be self-sustaining themselves and be able to build their own roaring fire. And that's—
Now, is it, before you go on, is it because they just lived really lavishly, like lifestyles of the rich and famous? That's why, and they didn't know how to manage it. You talked about like big West End parties, like Great Gatsby style, right?
They made keeping up with the Kardashians look like it was, you know, some pauper trailer park kind of a deal. I mean, it was— the Vanderbilt family were about as lavish living as you can possibly imagine. And they had the money to do it. Again, the financial assets are astonishing compared to some of the wealth that we're used to hearing about today with Warren Buffett and, again, Bill Gates and so forth. And not only that, you have to understand that the tax situation at that time was so much different than it is now. So the fluidity of money was much easier in a lot of different situations. And so they were able to just kind of pass it on. And what that, of course, amounted to was each of these generational levels having so much that they didn't have to do anything, right? That's the Warren Buffett sort of phrase, which is give your kids so much they can do anything, but not so much they can do nothing. Well, that's what the Vanderbilts did, which was a whole lot of nothing. And, you know, to contrast that with the Rothschild family, which is a European banking family, and if you combine that family's net worth with all of the fingers of the family, it is just— there's estimates that are just out astronomical about their level of net worth. But what they did was something completely different. You know, Commodore Rothschild was born in the streets of Amsterdam and as penniless and poor as you can possibly imagine, but he was great at bartering. And he built up this system of trade that eventually led him into getting into the banking industry. But as each of his children would come of age, he didn't just turn over a check for a bunch of money to them. He would send them to other centers of Europe and have them learn the banking industry, starting from the ground up in various banking institutions. And when they were ready and could look at help, maybe creating their own financial institution, then they would get kindling from the family in the form of financial wealth to help them start their fire of burning their own financial center there in these various areas of Europe. And it's taken root. I mean, it is so vast that it's incredible. But there's the two different paths where one, hey, we're just going to dump, divide, and defer all of the assets onto our next generation, where the other generation was, look, this is who we are as a family. These are who the Rothschilds are. We believe that, you know, in this banking philosophy and going out and what you know, our predecessors have done is a very important thing. And that then became the center of the family, so that when the parents passed away, that family was still cohesively centered around a common purpose. So much of estate planning now is a very matriarch or patriarchal type of a situation where you have mom and dad sort of at the top was king and queen with their disciples as the children underneath. And that problem with that is that as soon as mom and dad are gone, what is left holding the family together? And again, this idea is putting purpose to that, where the purpose of the family is binding everybody in that common goal.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Realty Shares. And before I get into explaining what Realty Shares is all about, it's a great way for people that don't have a lot of money to get started with real estate investing. I have to require, I have to read this required statement under the law. So here it is. It's not an offering of securities. Private investments are highly illiquid and risky and are not suitable for all investors. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Securities offered to accredited investors through North Capital Private Securities. It's a member FINRA SIPC. All right, great. Now that we got that legal disclaimer out of the way, I want to talk to you about what Realty Shares can do for you if you don't have a lot of money and you want to get started with real estate investing. I think this is a great way for investors who, let's say you have $5,000 and you qualify, now you can get started with real estate investing. You can basically work with RealtyShares.com. What they've done is they've demolished the walls between you and real estate investing. You no longer need billions of dollars or even tens of thousands of dollars to invest in actual real estate assets. What they've done is that they've brought hundreds of people together who invest fractionally in real estate. So you own a portion of the asset with your investment. So it reduces the cost of an initial investment. And then Realty Shares deals are vetted and curated by industry professionals who underwrite. And then they perform all the detailed due diligence. So you don't have to source any properties. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff yourself. All it takes is $5,000 to get started. There are no hidden fees. It's totally free to sign up. When I went through their website and went through the process of signing up, it's so simple to set up. And then you can just easily browse through investments that you want to get involved with. Getting set up just takes a few minutes. Then you can manage and invest straight from your phone or your computer through their simple and secure online process. So here's the deal. If you make $200,000 a year, you may qualify. All you need to do to get started, find out today, go to realtyshares.com/IIRE. That's our podcast, Investing in Real Estate. So you need to go to that URL, realtyshares.com/IIRE, and they're going to give you $100 towards your first investment just for coming over there. They're going to give you a free $100 just for going to that URL. But make sure you spell it correctly. Because some people get realty and they think that it needs to, you know, they spell it wrong. So it's not reality. It's realty. That's Realty Shares. And it's spelled R-E-A-L-T-Y. R-E-A-L-T-Y shares.com/IIRE. Get that $100 towards your first investment. It's a great way to even diversify the stuff that you're currently doing with real estate investing. Or if you don't have the cash to get started, all you need is $5,000 to start investing fractionally in real estate. Love them. Great. Go check them out. Thanks, Realty Shares, for your support of the podcast. Thanks so much. You know, when parents, you write in the book, as Natalie pointed out, that parents usually want to hide the ball when it comes to family wealth. What does that mean? Is it that they're not really informing their kids fully about what they're actually doing?
Yeah, and it typically, you know, obviously when we're talking about this being some sort of an effect on the family, it's usually when it's a wealthy family and they don't want to tell the next generation in essence how wealthy they are because they think that will somehow keep them from being motivated. Right. We're going to keep it quiet. We want them to feel like they've got to go and work and they're not going to have any big cushion of money to fall back on. And I absolutely understand where people are coming from on that. Hey, look, we don't want to create this safety net. We want people to be, you know, feeling like they've got to go out and produce on their own. Exactly. I love that idea. The problem is it just doesn't work. Your family members are not stupid and your children know, you know, what kind of a house they live in, and they compare them to the houses that their friends live in when they go to school. And they're not completely oblivious to the fact that they have a higher standard of living, and, you know, just making them sit in coach instead of first class on the airplane is not necessarily teaching them that lesson. In my mind, it's much more valuable to be open and say, look, this is what you can expect. You know, one of the things that we found, in fact, we have an article coming out in Trust and Estates magazine this next month on this topic, which is, you know, does this really have a meaningful effect with families, meaning having them know? And in fact, when a family member actually knows and understands what they are going to receive or understand what the rules of engagement here are after mom and dad pass away, there's an 83% chance that that family will be satisfied with the handling of the estate after that person dies. When it comes as a surprise, meaning nobody knows what's going to happen, there's only a 33% satisfaction rate. So if one of our goals here in doing estate planning is to make sure that your family is still all having Thanksgiving dinner together, the Thanksgiving after you pass away, meaning everybody's getting along, laying it out for everybody so there's no surprises certainly makes it much easier. I mean, we have this saying in the estate planning world that you never truly know a person until you share an inheritance with them. And that's the idea, is that you don't want there to be any surprises where the gloves come off and people start to fight.
And so maybe you could talk about all the things that goes into estate planning, because it took us several hours of document and questionnaire filling out and discussions between the two of us, and, you know, some civil, then some like, no, it's got to be my family to do that. You know, it's hard. Like, it's not easy to make these decisions. And we didn't realize that we'd not only have to plan who would take over our trust, and in the case of something happens to us, how we would hand those trusts out to our family, to our kids, who would make those decisions, who would have our medical power of attorney. So can you give sort of a short summation of everything that goes into estate planning? I know it took up a whole book, but.
Absolutely. Maybe I can set the stage just a little bit broader. Estate planning is a really broad topic. I mean, we immediately, when we hear that topic, jump to this idea of wills and trusts and what happens when you die. And that certainly is what we'll go over here in just a second, Natalie, because I think that's what you're referring to. But keep in mind, your estate is everything that you own, all of your assets, all of your business interests, your real estate, money in the bank, life insurance. All of this stuff builds up your estate. And when we say estate planning, it isn't just at death, it's also during your lifetime. So how do you protect that estate? So you have issues of asset protection planning and business structuring, and how do you make sure that your estate's functioning in the most tax efficient way? So we have tax planning and charitable giving and all these different things that come into this broad topic of estate planning. And sort of where we like everybody to start, which is what we refer to as the fundamental level of estate planning. And I do believe that everybody ought to have this. I don't care if you're Warren Buffett, who I guarantee has all of these documents, or you just graduated from college and you're just starting your life. These are important documents to have. And the reason for it is because in this first level of planning, what you are doing is taking control. I told you earlier that 70% of the population never does their estate planning, but what that 70% of the population doesn't understand is that it's already been done for them. Every state in the nation has a law that says how your assets are going to pass if you choose to plan otherwise. So coming in here and doing your own estate planning is you taking control of it and you deciding who are going to be making decisions for you and how assets are going to pass and so forth. And there's sort of five core documents that come in to build that structure for us, which are the last will and testament, a revocable living trust, power of attorney documents for healthcare decision making, and another power of attorney that covers financial decision making. And then finally, what I call the pull the plug document, for lack of a better phrase, but this is the living will or medical directive. And what you're trying to do in each of these documents is accomplish different goals, right? In your last will and testament, you know, one of the biggest goals there is to appoint guardians for your minor children. Right? Who is going to have custody of them? If something were to happen to you, who's going to raise, love, and nurture them as closely as you otherwise would have been able to do? Not necessarily who's going to be in charge of the money or assets that you leave them, but who's going to be in charge of them. Then you come down kind of to the trust, this revocable living trust. Revocable here meaning that you can always change it. You have a lot of flexibility with it. And living means that you create it while you're alive, and that trust sits beside you as your alter ego. And in that trust, you create the trust as the grantor of it. You're the trustee of that trust, so you're in control of it. And you're also the beneficiary of that trust, so you get a benefit by all the assets that get put into it. But now, because the trust comes in to own your assets, we get to accomplish one of these great goals of avoiding probate. This idea of if you pass away, your family not having to go to court and hiring blood-sucking lawyers like me and spending a bunch of time and money going through this court process of probate. If the trust owns your assets as opposed to you owning them personally, we get to avoid that whole process. We also primarily in the trust want to make sure that whoever you're leaving your assets to, you leave it to them in the most protective way. Remember I said again, every state has adopted this probate code, which says how assets are going to pass when you die. And, you know, if you have, you know, let's take a typical situation, which is not as typical anywhere close to as it used to be, but husband and wife with two kids. The probate code would say if mom and dad pass away, the kids receive the assets. The problem is Those assets will go in a custodial account managed by a court-appointed custodian until they reach the age of 18. And then at age 18, they get full access to those accounts. So with a trust, you can actually do something different. First of all, you can choose who you want to be in charge of the assets, not relying on the court. And I'm not trying to badmouth courts. I think they try to do the best that they can. But I always think that you have a better idea of who should do that than the court would. You also get to leave it to your kids in such a way that it can be protected for their entire lifetime. Your child goes through a divorce or a bankruptcy or gets involved in a lawsuit, maybe long after you're dead, the assets that you've left them, we can completely protect from any of those creditors. So a huge amount of protection, whereas if you go through probate or if you go through this idea of probate and the kids wind up with the assets at the age of 18, they're theirs. They get to do whatever the heck they want with it. So the trust is really a great vehicle to come in. And of course, there's a number of other goals depending upon people's situations.
When should you start this process, Andrew, with your family, even if you have no assets?
Yeah, absolutely. I always find out typically that people are worth a whole lot more than they think. When I do a plan for somebody like you guys, right, we sent you data sheets and questionnaires and all of these types of things, and we always get back kind of a general understanding of people's assets. And always get this, hey, do I make sense doing estate? Well, yeah, you've got $1 million life insurance policy right there. You got a lot of money that we're talking about, but I don't have any money in the bank. So yeah, we do like people to start early. In fact, we even have programs for our clients whose children are coming of age, right? They're 18 years old. Maybe they're going to college. Maybe they're going on a religious mission, something like that, those types of things. They're leaving the nest. Well, they're adults now. And if something, God forbid, were to happen to them, and let's say they needed to have a healthcare decision made for them, well, you're no longer their legal guardian as soon as they reach adulthood. So like with these other documents, we talk the will and the trust, the power of attorney documents, where while you're alive, but for some reason you're unable to make your own decisions, you, by these power of attorney documents, give the power to the people you want to make your healthcare decisions and your financial decisions. And so, to what degree you need all of these documents might fluctuate depending upon your circumstances. But I'm a big fan of control. I like to at least control the things in my lives that I can control. And this was one of those things. I can, if I take a little time, dictate who I want my kids to go to. I can dictate how I want my assets to pass to my children, and in such a way that they could be the most fabulous people on the face of the earth, but I still want to protect those assets for their benefit. And I also want to make sure that if something happened to me or my wife, I have somebody making the decisions for me in regards to my health care or my finances that I chose. Now, I don't think any of that depends upon the dollar amount that you have in the bank. I mean, I think that those would be goals for everybody.
What about, and we'll get you out of here on this because we want to definitely get into business entity structuring, and unless there's anything else that Natalie wanted to talk about on the, on the basic estate planning, but the idea of being able to talk to your children about this, how do you, our son is 6 and our daughter's 4, and now we've got a 6-month-old that you can hear in the background. How do you begin to try to communicate this with your children?
So we've sort of found as we've taken families through our entrusted planning process that 5 years old is usually a pretty good age to start introducing to them these ideas to them. And I know that sounds pretty young, but obviously you introduce it to them in age appropriate ways, right? You don't print off the balance sheet and show it to a 5-year-old and ask them to understand it. But you can start talking to them about who you guys are as a family and what is it that, makes you unique, Clayton and Natalie. What is it that makes you unique? And what is it that makes your kids all unique? But then what is the shared goals that you have as a family? And one of the things from the book, my partner David developed a board game. It's called Rivets. And this board, it's literally just a card game that anybody can play. And we've had, again, kids, you've got to be able to read, but it's kids as young as 7, 8 years old who can play it pretty well. And it really starts these ideas and these juices flowing of creating common core values and principles of the family. And also what's fascinating is you're able to identify in other family members what you feel their qualities are. And sometimes I think that we forget how important that is, right? We always want to try to say that other people's opinions of us don't matter, but in reality, they really do. And when you have your family there and they can tell you what they see those strengths in you are, it's sometimes validating.
That's great. And tons of valuable information. And of course, you can dive much more deeply into all of this, even by booking a call with Andrew and his team and going through the basics of estate planning. Read the book, Entrusted, and take those next steps. Natalie, any other questions on the basics of estate planning?
No, but I have plenty of specific questions. So hopefully everyone tunes into the next episode with Andrew, because this is just, it's such great stuff. And I can't recommend this book enough. And you know, just so everyone knows, the way we're affiliated with Andrew is that we're clients of his, very happy clients, but there's a lot that goes into it and I'm always learning. So I'm so glad you joined us today.
My pleasure, you guys. It's been fun. Thank you.
And our thanks to all of you for subscribing and downloading the podcast. As you know, we publish every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So thank you so much for all of your kind five-star reviews in the iTunes store as well. We really appreciate that. We'll be back tomorrow with another episode. But don't forget, we will be back with Andrew again next week for part two of our in-depth interview about estate planning. And next, we're going to be talking about basic entity structuring. When should investors, you know, begin to start building an estate plan? And we'll dive into all of that with your LLCs and your assets and your trusts and some nitty-gritty stuff. That'll be next week right here on the podcast. Until next time, everyone, go out there, take action, and become a real estate investor. We'll see you next time, everyone.